And it doesn't necessarily, part of our rhythm at church each week is that we hear scriptures read that aren't necessarily what we preach. We really believe in hearing the scripture sometimes being heard raw and uninterpreted. We also believe in hearing it in other languages, like what Sam brought in Cambodian and what John brought in English, because God's causing us a foretaste of the new heavens and new earth when people of every nation and tongue will worship God together. So that's why we do that stuff. It's pretty cool, eh? Why don't you all turn towards the center here? I just want you to focus in on Sam and Adrian. Give us a wave, Sam and Adrian. I'm not doing this for no reason. We need to give these guys our congratulations. They are now 20 weeks pregnant. So we're really thrilled for you guys and hope that this journey is a really good one for you. I think that everybody has a belief about how salvation works. And that's both in the church and out of the church. Everybody has a belief about how salvation works. We may not put it into words, we may not be vocal about this stuff, but everyone lives with a working theory of salvation. How do you find success? What would you call happiness? What makes something good and what makes something bad? What would you consider to be sickness, and what would you consider to be healing? These questions, they sound abstract, but they're answered by the way we live. What's your theory of salvation and your view of the good life? Well, your everyday actions display your answer. For example, the congratulations we might offer to first home buyers and the interest we pay in each other's home improvements. Maybe it says that salvation is about getting ahead. The attention we pay to physical health issues and our relative silence about other things says that we think salvation is about not having to suffer. And the people we spend our time with and the places in which we dwell, maybe they say something about our picture of the good life, what we think is successful. Our beliefs about salvation are there for everyone to see, revealed in the functional ways we live our lives. That's true not only of individuals, but of us as a church together, in the patterns of our actions when we gather. And one of those actions we do is this strange micro meal that we take every couple of weeks, not this week, after the sermon. We eat the rice cracker or the little cube of white bread, and we take that sip of red cordial, believing that this lies at the heart of our story of salvation. It's a little bit crazy. At its worst, the supper feels like a tack on at the end of the service, just something that we do because tradition tells us we have to do it. But at its best, and I hope you've had this experience, at its best, it feels sacred and meaningful, as if the veil of heaven is pulled back for a moment and we get a glimpse of God's glory, like on the mountain where Jesus was transfigured before their eyes. What is this thing that some of us call communion, others call the Lord's Supper, and still others call the Eucharist? What's meant by these words, "This is my body broken for you, and this is my blood poured out for you"? You're probably aware of some of the debates that happen in church about this meal. Some people think that the bread and the wine or the juice literally becomes Christ's body. Others say it's just symbolic. Some people think that the table should be open to everyone, a common meal. Others think it's for those who are baptized. And what about children? Are they welcome here at the table too? What's the best way to serve the supper? Are we fans of the dipping? Or do we prefer to sip in our seats? Or do we like a big loaf broken and it's shared as part of a big meal? Churches have split over our table manners. There's lots we could say about this thing, and some of which we probably shouldn't. In our lead up to Easter, I want us to better understand the Lord's Supper. By exploring the scriptures together, my hope is that we will come and end up with a richer, more textured experience of the supper. enabling us to more tangibly experience the gospel of Jesus together. That's my hope. Hopefully it's a good hope. We want to experience the gospel more, right? I'd also like to consider us making this a weekly rhythm, a practice that lies at the very heart of our gathering together. I think we should think carefully about the Lord's Supper, because our beliefs about salvation are on display in the patterns of our actions. They're there for everyone to see. The Lord's Supper only emerged in the New Testament with Jesus and his disciples, but its roots are deep in the Old Testament, in the story of Israel. In fact, I think the Lord's Supper can be seen as a uniting story of the Bible, of God's saving relationship with humanity. The most obvious echo of the supper in the Old Testament is the Passover. To help us understand the Passover, I'm going to read from the Jesus Storybook Bible. Anyone come across this book? It's a good book. This is the story of the Exodus. God to the rescue. Joseph and his brothers grew old and died. But their children's children stayed on in Egypt, where they became a very large family. Later on, a new king began to rule. But this Pharaoh didn't remember Joseph, and he didn't like God's people. He made them into his slaves and beat them and made them work harder and harder. God's people cried out to God to rescue them, and God heard them. He remembered his promise to Abraham. He would look after his people. He would find a way to set them free. One day, Moses was looking after sheep when something caught his eye. A bush was behaving very oddly. It was flickering with flames, but its leaves weren't burning up. He took a closer look. "Moses," boomed a big voice. Moses leaped back. The bush was talking to him. "I have heard my people's cries," God said. "I have seen their tears. So I have come down to rescue them. Go to Pharaoh and tell him to let my people go free." Moses was afraid, but God said, "I'll be with you." So Moses went to Pharaoh. "Pharaoh," Moses began. "God says..." "God?" said Pharaoh. "Never heard of him." Moses kept going. "God says, let his people go free." "Why should I?" Pharaoh said. "Don't want to, won't." So he didn't. So God gave Pharaoh 10 warnings, called plagues. First, God turned the River Nile into blood. No one could drink the water. But still, Pharaoh would not let them go. So God made frogs come hopping and leaping and jumping. "In your bed, frogs. In your hair, frogs. In your soup, frogs. All over everywhere, frogs." "Make them go away," Pharaoh screamed. "Then your people can go." So God took the frogs away. But Pharaoh changed his mind. "You can't go," he said. Then God sent zillions of gnats. That's from the King James Version, zillions of gnats. But still, Pharaoh said, "No." So then God sent swarms of flies, flies buzzing in your eyes, flies. And after that, sickness and horrible boils and huge hailstones and a storm of locusts, then darkness when it should have been day, until it seemed that the whole world, creation and everything, was coming undone, falling back into darkness and emptiness and nothingness. But each time, Pharaoh said, "Stop, and then I'll let them go." And each time, God made it stop. Pharaoh changed his mind and said, "Actually, no, you can't go." Finally, Moses warned Pharaoh, "Obey God, or he will have to send the worst thing of all." Pharaoh just laughed. So God said, "The oldest boy in each family of Egypt must die, but my people will be safe." God told his people to take a lamb, their best lamb, to kill it and to put some of its blood on their front doors. When God passes over your house, Moses explained, God will see the blood and know that the lamb died instead of you. That night, just as God had said, suddenly, piercing the darkness, echoing down the corridors of the palace, came a blood-curdling scream. Pharaoh's oldest son had died. At last, Pharaoh did what God said. Get out, Pharaoh shouted. Just go. And so that very night, Moses and God's people fled out of Egypt and out of slavery. They were free at last. God's people would always remember this great rescue and call it Passover. But an even greater rescue was coming. Many years later, God was going to do it again. He was going once more to rescue his people. But this time, God was going to set them free forever and ever. So that's the story of the Exodus, and it's remembered in the Passover. In the Exodus, God delivered Israel from the tyranny of Pharaoh. He brought them out of Egypt so that they should worship him in freedom in their own land. And they lived happily ever after. Not. The crazy thing is, no sooner had God brought them out into the wilderness, out of Egypt, than the Israelites were tempted back to Egypt from where they'd just escaped. While Moses was up on the mountain talking with God, they were already making themselves a golden calf to worship. And time and again, when they were in the promised land, the Israelites were tempted back to Egypt, back to the ways of slavery under other gods and other rulers. The same thing happens for many people in the church today, for you and I. We know that Jesus has freed us from the handcuffs of sin, yet we put them back on all the time. We're tempted back to Egypt. Take David Brooks' example of an upwardly mobile Christian businesswoman. Erica, a company CEO, had dinner with a celebrated business leader, someone she had admired for many years. After a business lunch in her hotel suite, Erica and the business celebrity committed adultery together. About an hour later after this act, Erica was overwhelmed with pain, shame, and regret. And she was shocked. Her marriage was healthy. She wasn't lonely. She felt betrayed by herself. How did I let this happen? Like she'd been someone else when she was with that businessman. But our beliefs about salvation are there for all to see, revealed in the functional ways we live our lives. Her slide into the slavery wasn't sudden, wasn't spontaneous. No, this story took place in the context of a long line of decisions, small decisions, that left her affections and her desires distorted with a false view of the good life. Through thousands of small actions, through the slow movement of her affections and desires, this was really who Erica had become. Her definition of success and the good life had changed. So here, Erica was acting in a drama that made committing adultery with a business celebrity the obvious decision to make. It made sense for the story of success that she had come to believe. Like the Israelites, the followers of Jesus are constantly tempted back to Egypt. Through the alternative stories of salvation we see and the shifting of our desires and affections for their image of success, as we see it on TV, as we see it in the workplace, as we see it in the schoolyard. Thanks be to God, his act for salvation wasn't one-off. God acts to release us from our chains again and again and again. Consider the Israelites. Not long after they committed adultery with this other god by making this golden calf, God gave them a special practice to help them come back out of Egypt. He told them to celebrate the Passover in the first month of every year, in the month of Abib. It involved pilgrimage to the temple. It involved coming together in community. It involved blood through sacrifice and diet through taking unleavened bread for a week. And then there was a final day of rest. God gave them a tangible, embodied practice of remembrance. The Passover was about remembering the Exodus. Not like you need to remember your wife's birthday, but remembering as identity formation. Remembering their way into God's story of salvation. Remembering that we have been delivered from slavery. A lived, performed reenactment of the Exodus story. Come out of Egypt. In the celebration of the Passover, the Spirit caused those past events of the Exodus to be a present and lived reality. So that as they ate this meal overnight, they're reminded, oh yeah, this is who we are. This is who our God is. What were we thinking? The Spirit inserted them into the history of God's salvation. Notice how in the book of Joshua, for example, we have this generation after the Exodus. They haven't been born. They weren't part of the original Passover. They've only heard the stories. And God says to them through Joshua, you saw with your own eyes what I did to the Egyptians. No, we didn't. I wasn't even born yet. You saw it. As you enter the Passover, you have been reinserted into that story yourself. What your ancestors saw is what you saw. Telling the story brings it alive. Each person comes to see his or herself as if they have personally come out of Egypt themselves. Welcome, my family. There's my daughter. She's just arrived. It's hard to keep focused when you. The Israelites, here we go. The Israelites had these practices of worship and identity formation. In the same way, I deeply believe that Sunday gatherings have this formational power. They may be a bit stuffy at times, but I think God works on us in here so that we can creatively and faithfully respond out there in the situations that we have to face. Sunday trains us for Monday. For example, God forms us to be generous in our lives by getting us to pass this little bag along the rows and put some coins in it if we have any. God forms us to be a people ready to sing to the King because we sing to the King on Sunday. God trains us to be hospitable with our workmates and our neighbours because here we have to rub shoulders with people that we normally wouldn't spend time with otherwise. This is a training ground. And at the table of the Lord's Supper, Jesus bids us to come and eat his flesh and blood, not that we might come out of Egypt, but that we might come out of the deeper abyss of slavery and sin. At the table, Jesus restores us to our true inheritance as sons and daughters, adopted by the Spirit into the Son's relationship with his Father. He liberates us to be who we truly are. It involves the breaking of bread, the pouring of juice. It says of Christ's body broken for us and Christ's blood poured out for us, this do in remembrance of me. The connections between the Lord's Supper and the Passover can illuminate, I think, what we're meant to see by remembrance. In the celebration of the Lord's Supper, the Spirit causes those past events of Jesus' death and resurrection at the cross to be our present and lived reality. This is who God is. Oh, this is who I am. The Spirit in the Supper inserts us into that story as our story, gets us to see the world right side up. It's as if the veil of heaven gets pulled back for a moment and we get to see a glimpse of the world as it really is. And one day will be in its totality, reflecting the glory of Jesus. What about Erica and her fall into sin and adultery? Having been brought sharply to her senses, she knows that she needs to come away from this, turn back, come back to some form of reality that's more appropriate. And so she comes to her pastor and shares her story, hoping for redemption. And what should the pastor do? should she or he say, oh dear, and pray with them, and hopefully God will form you to be better the next time? Will the pastor say, Jesus forgives you, just try harder? No. Learning from the Passover and the Lord's Supper, the pastor points her towards a new way of life, brought into a community of word and sacrament, with its shared habits of prayer, worship, Bible study, service, and witness. Yet this isn't just a human practice that will lead to change. We're not doing much here. It's the Holy Spirit's work in uniting her, uniting us to Christ and his people, bringing us slowly yet surely to recognize and participate in the drama of being a child of God. In all these practices, the Spirit can reshape her loves, her affections, and her actions, just like he does for us. In the celebration of the Passover, the Spirit causes the past events of the Exodus to be the Israelites' present and lived reality. This is who we are. And so in the celebration of the Lord's Supper, the Spirit causes the past event of Christ's death and resurrection to be our lived and present reality. Jesus is here among you, causing you to be the people of the cross. Our beliefs about salvation are there for everyone to see, revealed in the breaking of bread and the pouring of juice. May the Spirit lead us over these weeks into a richer, more textured experience of the supper together, enabling us to tangibly experience the gospel of Jesus in our midst. We're going to sing some songs, and I'd love to invite the band back up. Something I'm aware of with communion is that we're talking about something that's lived, that's tangible, that's there to practice. And I think we have the same invitation in our worship. You know, this isn't a game of musical statues where we have to sort of sing like this. We actually have bodies that have limbs that can move and can kind of, I don't know, can go up like this and can go like this. We have bodies that can dance, that can move. And there's something about our posture.